Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. On our show today, we're going to hear from trailblazing women with inspiring stories. We'll hear about an African-American teacher who went to college back when most Americans didn't finish high school.
Mrs. Fleming modeled for all of us. It's not that she did not see the barriers, but she would not be defined by them. And she wouldn't let them limit her.
We'll also hear from Concord University's president, Dr. Kendra Baugus.
What I have been told my whole life is there were two choices for women at that time. I could be a nurse or I could be a teacher. That really was about it. There really weren't a lot of other options.
And we'll meet Judy Shepherd.
I feel that I have a calling. I think that God gave me a gift, and that gift is to help people.
You'll find these stories and more this week Inside Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Thanks for tuning in. You're one of a growing number of fans of Inside Appalachia. Thank you for telling your friends, and thank you for subscribing to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. On our last show, we talked with young people who are determined to get through college even though no one in their family has done it before. And that got us to thinking about trailblazers. People who overcome tough obstacles and find success and wind up being an inspiration to the rest of us. On today's show, we'll hear from some remarkable women whose determination changed their own lives and changed the other people's lives too.
My father was a carpenter. My mother, she died young. I'm the eldest of my brothers. You're the trouble in my blood. Trouble in my blood. I swore that I'd stay humble like my father was before. He built the home I live in of sand and mud and smoke. Sand and mud and smoke. Yes, we will leave here without a trace. Take a new name and an old shape. I'll be no outlaw, no renegade. Just your faithful God of laws.
We'll begin by hearing about two African American women. One of them was a high school teacher, and the other was her student. And both of them did something unusual for African-American women of their generation. They went to college. Eunice Fleming started school in the 1940s and went on to become a teacher. One of her students was Ollie Watts Davis. On a recent Sunday morning, Ollie Watts Davis came to Mount Hope, West Virginia, for a celebration honoring her teacher. Our producer, Roxy Todd, was there.
It seemed like the entire town of Mount Hope had turned out to thank Eunice Fleming for being their teacher. Inside the Presbyterian Church, I saw hundreds of people, all different shades of black and white. They'd gathered just to celebrate this one woman who taught high school music and business for over 40 years.
If I can help somebody as I pass alone. If I can cheer.
That's Dr. Ethel Caffey Austin singing. She's been called West Virginia's First Lady of Gospel because she's had such a successful gospel music career. And she says it all started with her high school music teacher, Mrs. Fleming.
She showed her love still flowed out. Even though she was stern, you knew she cared. And that makes a lot of difference. When you're working with kids, I ended up becoming a teacher. Lord have mercy.
Mrs. Fleming had a tough love style of teaching, which sometimes included disciplining students with paddling. She called her paddle the Board of Education. But many students talked about how they looked up to her. Here's former student Ollie Watts Davis.
Mrs. Fleming modeled for all of us. It's not that she did not see the barriers, but she would not be defined by them. And she wouldn't let them limit her.
And there were barriers. In Mrs. Fleming's day, most Americans didn't finish high school, let alone go to college. The people who did go to college were mostly young white men from elite upper-class families, not black women from coal camps. But Mrs. Fleming went on further than that and even got her master's degree. She was the first African-American to present a master's recital at Marshall University. I got to thinking about how much determination and talent it must have taken her to do all that. I wanted to hear more about Mrs. Fleming. So a few weeks later, I returned to Mount Hope and I went to her home.
Hi. I'm good. Are you Ken?
Yes, I am.
Hey, I'm Roxy.
Roxy, pleasure to meet you. Come right on in.
Her son Ken sat with us in her living room, which was full of pictures of her grandchildren. Mrs. Fleming and I sat with TV trays in front of our laps. She handed me a photograph from her grade school, which was one of those old wooden schoolhouses.
This was second, third, and fourth grade.
So it was about four rooms in there?
Four rooms in there.
Mrs. Fleming's dad and most of the other dads in her community worked in the coal mines. But Eunice Fleming's parents pushed her and her siblings to go to college. She was valedictorian of her high school. She went through high school very quickly and was still a teenager when she went to college.
Did you know that that's remarkable? That that's an amazing accomplishment?
Not necessarily so. Then.
You're modest.
Now, of course, when she was going to college in the 1940s, black people weren't always allowed to go to the same schools as whites. She went to a black college in southern West Virginia.
I went to Bluefield State. I had an excellent teacher, Dr. C.D. Reese from California. He just really encouraged you to finish college.
Dr. Reese pushed her to go on to do graduate work. By this time, it was 1944, and she'd already started her teaching career at DuBois High School. She was the youngest faculty member at the time. DuBois was the black high school. She continued teaching there as DuBois became integrated after Brown versus Board of Education. Meanwhile, Mrs. Fleming was taking graduate courses at Marshall University and at the University of Michigan. In 1944, Eunice Fleming was one of just a few black students in her program studying in the University of Michigan.
We were the first four blacks who...
And her son Ken told me that the white students refused to sit next to her in class. Every single chair around her was empty. But the other students got friendlier once they realized she had a lot of musical talent and knowledge. Ken grew up hearing these stories. He also remembers his mother was in high demand around Fayette County and spent a lot of her time singing at local events.
A lot of my childhood memories growing up were going with her to performances.
And she even had offers to come teach at colleges.
Because she had the ability to actually be at the Metropolitan Opera.
But she didn't go to the Metropolitan Opera. Instead, she stayed in Mount Hope because she felt that her most important work was to teach young students. She pushed many of them to go to college.
Try to encourage students like that.
But why? Why did you think it was important to push them to go to college?
Because they had the talent. And that means they had the talent to do more than they were doing.
One of the most successful students Mrs. Fleming mentored is Dr. Ollie Watts Davis. Mrs. Fleming was her basketball coach.
And we would be traveling on the school bus and singing all the top 40 tunes from on the radio, and we would be singing them as we traveled to and from the games. And she encouraged me to join the chorus. At that time, I think it was my freshman year, I was not in the choir. And she said, "Oh, you have a fine voice, and I think that you would really enjoy being there." I had some friends in the chorus. And so the next year I did join, and she auditioned me to be part of a small group of students who were selected to represent the school at a festival, at the county festival, as well as at the all-state chorus. And that was really a magical moment for me, being there with other students my age who had been selected by their teachers and regarded in such a high way. So that really inspired me, and then I went on to college and studied music education, and all along the way, she has been very supportive of all of my endeavors.
Ollie Watts Davis has had a successful music career. She got a Doctor of Musical Arts degree from the University of Illinois, and she's performed all over the world. When she made her debut at Carnegie Hall in 1990, Mrs. Fleming came to New York to see it. And like Mrs. Fleming taught her, Ollie says she's been able to push through barriers and find a source of strength through music. For Ollie,
Music is much more than a career.
I actually wrote a piece for the sesquicentennial of the Emancipation Proclamation. You know, that just happened in, 2013? For my campus, the University of Illinois, and it's called I Hear Freedom. I start the piece as a cantata for a solo voice, choir, a cappella, and accompanied. And it starts with that spiritual, oh, freedom. I sort of took some artistic license with the text, and I said, oh, freedom over me. And before I be a slave, I would sing my soul away and go home with my Lord and be free. I would release myself through song, because I believe that there's a liberating factor as a performer when I'm on stage or in a practice room or wherever when I'm singing. It's a spiritual experience, and there's a tremendous sense of liberty when I'm doing that. So before I'd be enslaved or limited, I would just take up song and liberate myself.
Here's that version of Oh Freedom, arranged by Ollie Watts Davis and performed by some of her music students at the University of Illinois.
Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom of me.
Over the years, Ollie Watts Davis has stayed in touch with the teacher who led her to become a musician.
But I think that she chose, in her generation, to make her greatest contribution in the classroom as a practicing teacher.
As I sat and talked with Ollie, we were in a sunlit room inside the Mount Hope Presbyterian Church. Ollie had just driven in from Illinois to perform for Mrs. Fleming's tribute concert. Inside the sanctuary, where hundreds of people had come to celebrate, Ollie sang this song called You'll Never Walk Alone. Then, towards the very end of the concert, 93-year-old Mrs. Fleming came up to the stage with the help of her walker to receive an award.
I want to thank everybody, in particular my sweethearts. I could tell so many things, but I just want to do this.
Mrs. Fleming then sat down at the piano to play a church song called Give Me a Clean Heart. She didn't want to make a speech. All she wanted to do was play her former students one more song. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Mount Hope, West Virginia.
Thanks to the Mountain of Hope and Mount Hope High School Alumni Association for the recordings of Ollie Watts Davis and Ethel Caffey Austin.
If I can help somebody as I pass alone.
I'm Jessica Lilly. You're Inside Appalachia. Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry, Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and listen on your own time. Still to come, we'll hear the story of a woman who was the first in her family to go to college and is now running the show as president of a university. It's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. For her story about Miss Fleming, Roxy Todd has been spending time in Mount Hope, West Virginia, talking with Miss Fleming's family and her former students. And it got us to thinking that there just might be a neat story about how the town of Mount Hope got its name. Was it because it was founded by Bob Hope? Yeah, okay, probably not. How about the hope-inspiring views that incoming settlers first noticed? Or was it named after a young girl named Hope who lived in the area? We'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So how did Mount Hope, West Virginia get its name? We reached out to a local historian, David Sibre, to get help with this one.
The story of Mount Hope begins long before its history as a coal town, 100 years before. In the early 1800s, William Blake settled in this little valley, the valley of Dunlop Creek, which by some accounts was known as Egypt because it was an incredibly fertile valley. It was in a warm valley. It was in a sheltered situation. In the 1870s, finally, they decided to build a schoolhouse, and that schoolhouse was known as Mount Hope School because of, and I've never seen the exact documentation, but because of the hopefulness. It always had been a valley that seemed to inspire hope in people.
And David says that there's something about the geography of the area that seems to inspire a sense of, well, hopefulness.
Even myself now, as I travel into that valley coming in from Beckley, I notice at the very top of the hill, just as I cross the brink into the valley, I notice there are more leaves on the trees. I notice in spring that things are already beginning to flower there. I notice in fall that the leaves are still hanging onto the trees. So even today, it's a sheltered valley.
The small town of Mount Hope has suffered its share of setbacks in recent years because of the decline in the coal industry. But if you happen to visit Mount Hope and talk with the folks in the communities there, David says people don't seem to have given up. And I think the story we heard earlier in our show about Miss Fleming speaks to that strong sense of resilience among some of the women of Mount Hope. If you have another story about Mount Hope or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name, and we might explore it inside Appalachia.
If I can point somebody.
This week, we're talking about trailblazers, women trailblazers to be exact. These are successful Appalachians who defeated the odds. While we were researching this show, we came across some statistics that surprised us. Across the country, there's a wide income gap between men and women. But here in West Virginia, income disparities are even more. The numbers are pretty staggering. In West Virginia, if you're a man without a high school degree, your income, on average, is $26,000. But a woman without a high school degree earns only $13,000, half as much. This is likely due in part to the number of skilled labor jobs that are traditionally held by men, like coal mining, for example. There's still a wage gap between men and women who have college degrees, though, but it's not as big. In West Virginia, if you're a man with a college education, you earn about $49,000 on average. But for women, it's about $35,000. A lot less than men make, but way better than $13,000 women make without a high school degree. So what do these numbers suggest? Well, for a woman, a college degree can be even more necessary to earning a living wage. So what could help encourage more young women from Appalachia to get a college degree and succeed? Teachers like Miss Fleming, who we heard about earlier in the show, do make a significant impact. And for all of you teachers out there, seriously, thank you. Many studies say that college advisors and professors who give positive encouragement to students can have a long-lasting effect on those students. College graduates who had positive interactions with mentors in college self-reported that they find it easier to be motivated in their jobs and careers later in life. The next person we're going to hear from encouraged me to pursue the job I wanted as part of a class assignment. It was during my senior year, not long after my daughter was born. Full disclosure, she's now the president of Concord University, one of our main sponsors. But that's not why we talked to her. We thought you'd be interested in hearing her story. Dr. Kendra Baugus was the first in her family to attend college, from scrubbing floors at her parents' business in Florida to a university president in West Virginia. Becoming the first female president of Concord University, she doesn't have your typical higher education background. Kendra Baugus recently sat down with me to chat and share her journey from a first-generation college student to a college president.
And when I finished high school, my mother was determined that I would get a degree from college. She didn't have one. My dad was a 10th grade dropout. My mom did finish high school, and then she went to beauty school. So she became a cosmetologist and did hair, and she wanted me to have a degree.
What were some of the things that she would say specifically to you about going to college and getting an education?
She knew I was very independent, and she always believed that I needed to be able to take care of myself. So I think, you know, most people at the time, my family came, I mean, they were raised during the Depression, and I know that there were very, very tough times. My mom was like 12 years old when she was moved out of her home and went to another home to take care of children for another family. But my grandmother did that when she was like 7. So we, you know, we were pretty impoverished by the standards, but I think everybody was then. My father was from a family, they were shopkeepers. They ran, I guess they were called locker plants, where people would bring their meats and cheeses and things, and they would store them in the locker. There was only one place in town where there was ice, and they ran one of those. And so my dad had that background, and it was about hard work. So I guess what I learned from both my parents is 24/7 you worked. I mean, when my parents started our store, they borrowed about $3,000 to start our store. And they literally, I can remember them getting up at 2:30 and 3 in the morning and going to work in another town, because we didn't have our store in the same city as we lived. But they wouldn't get home till 10 o'clock at night, and they'd get up and do it again. And they did that for about 3 or 4 years because they refused to borrow money. They borrowed money against their home. That was it. And I can actually remember the first time they decided they could go out to dinner. It was 3 years after they started their store. So thrift, you know, working hard, you know, doing things as smart as you could. But, I mean, it was just nothing but hard work.
You mentioned that your dad had a 10th grade education. Did he ever say anything about education?
Yes, he did. And I guess that's one of the things that most touched my heart when I was younger, because when he was in his probably mid-30s, his high school class, the one that he would have graduated with, was going to have a reunion, and he wasn't invited. He was actually voted the least likely to succeed in his class, and that hurt him. I mean, you know, as a young person looking at your father and hearing him say that, he was always like Mr. Party. He always had a lot of fun, but he wasn't very serious. And he was 14 or 15 years old when he joined the service during the war. So he lied about his age to get in the military. And he went, you know, and I've recently uncovered all the letters that he had written his parents. And I mean, he would send $4 home a week or $5 home a week. It's a story about America, I think. And it's a story about how hard people then worked, and they didn't think anything of it, and they always wanted better for us. But he, you know, I can remember him saying, Kendra, get all the English you can. And I loved to write, and I was a good writer, and I loved to read. And at that time in his career, it was before he started his store, he worked for a large company, And he would have to go to sales meetings, and he had to get up in front of people and speak. And he said, you know, I'm always embarrassed when I do that because I don't know the right words. And it just killed me. I mean, I just always remember thinking, yeah, I really need to do that. I mean, I was good at it, luckily, but it just made me feel so badly for him that he didn't feel like he could do well in his company because he didn't have that degree. He wasn't finished. So.
But Kendra's father wasn't sure she was ready for college, and he still wasn't convinced that going to college was a way to become successful. After all, he had a 10th grade education and ran a successful business. Kendra attended St. Petersburg College, formerly St. Petersburg Junior College. It was the late 1960s, and the community college in Florida had about 20,000 students at the time.
I did well, and I transferred to the University of Florida. What I had been told my whole life is there were two choices for women at that time. I could be a nurse, or I could be a teacher. That really was about it. There really weren't a lot of other options. But when I got to the University of Florida, one of the math professors that I had, who was just incredibly bright, came to me and he asked me if I would be a math major. And to tell you how naive I was, I just thought, what in the world would I do with a math major? You know, I just couldn't even imagine it because how could I get a job? And my family was so career focused. I grew up in a small business. And, you know, how could I use that? I mean, there's only so much math you can do in a grocery store. And so I didn't see beyond that because there was really no one to help me understand it. So I just went into education. For a while, I thought I was going to go in psychology because I had a great interest in that. But I didn't like the kind of psychology they had there. It was experimental psych, and it wasn't in my interest area. So I ended up going into teaching. So that was my undergraduate degree. After I graduated, there were no jobs in teaching, so I went back to work at my parents' store, and I worked there for about 3 years. I was in charge of wine and cheese and everything else. I mean, when you grow up in a store, you do whatever has to be done, whether it's, you know, scrubbing the floors or building shelving or whatever. We did it all.
Kendra wound up working in an architecture firm. Then she moved to West Virginia with her husband, who was an architect.
And I was offered a job here at Concord. Now, I had an undergraduate degree, and I taught one class. And it became very clear to me very quickly that that was not enough, so I went back to school. And luckily, there was a program in my area of interest at Virginia Tech. They took me, if I would go and take some classes and do well, they would take me into the program. And so as a non-traditional student, that was one of the pathways. And I went there and I earned my master's degree. And I thought, that's it. I'm not going to do that anymore. And I realized in order to become tenured here, I would need to go on. So I went back. And I earned my doctorate there. So that's my educational history.
When you were talking about going to school and how, you know, you reached this point, what were some of the unique struggles that you think you faced because you were a first-generation college student?
Well, there were a lot of things. And I not only was I first-generation, I was old. I was older when I started to school. So a lot of our students are non-traditional. They've worked for a while. And many of them feel, at least in my experience here in teaching them, they feel like they're going to be behind. But they're not. They're ahead because they know what they want to do. And so, and they're also mature. So they don't come, while it's great to come as an 18-year-old and have the fun of growing up and having all the friendships and things, those are wonderful opportunities. But if you don't have that, it's also great to find out that you can achieve, and you can achieve at levels at least as good, if not better, than traditional age students. So going back to school, the challenge for me was that I was working full-time. I was chair of the division of business. I was driving 2 hours, probably most days, to Virginia Tech for almost 10 years, off and on. Mm-hmm. Every summer, I took classes. We were, at the time, in our family business, and my husband's business, there were some tough times, and so we were stretching every dollar and trying to find help I was fortunate that at Virginia Tech, at times my advisors would come and say, you know, we've got a scholarship, would that help? And it's like, yes, it would help tremendously, you know. So, you know, it was just, it's kind of an overwhelming task to take on when you're older. And yet our non-traditional students do every bit as well. They finish beautifully. So those are the challenges that I think I shared with the non-traditional students who are also first generation.
I know that I've told you this several times, that your encouragement in my class helped me to go out there and get my first job. And I'm very happy with where I am right now, so I'm thankful for that, and that encouragement was important to me.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you've done so well, but I knew you would, because you were on your way.
That was Kendra Baugus, the current president of Concord University. For our final story, we got some help from the West Virginia Public Broadcasting series, Inspiring West Virginians. The ongoing series tells the stories of West Virginians who are exceptional leaders in science and business. Judy Shepherd has come a long way for her success and is adamant about remembering her roots in West Virginia. Judy grew up with what she calls nothing. No electricity, no running water, no telephone, no television, no toys. Now, she's the leader of a successful business based in her home state. Reporter Jean Snediger shares the story of Judy Shepherd.
I feel that I have a calling. I think that God gave me a gift. And that gift is to help people.
And we can also bill for those this week.
Okay. With the new system up and running, we're going to look at our financials first.
I'm Judy K. Shepherd, and I was born in a little town called Blue Goose, West Virginia, and that's in Rome County, West Virginia. And I am now the president and CEO of Professional Services of America, Inc., located in Parkersburg, West Virginia.
How is it going to work differently than what we're doing now with the ADP?
It's going to be along the same lines.
Professional Services of America, or PSA, is a multi-million dollar company that provides recruiting and staffing services, accounting services, and many other kinds of services to some of America's largest corporations, including DuPont and GE, as well as 32 government agencies. Judy Shepherd launched the company in 1989.
We started out with just really kind of nothing, and it just kind of blossomed and grew, and we got a good reputation, and honesty and integrity was how I promoted it. And I always tell the people that I would interview that worked for me or wanted to work with me is, I don't know if you want to work for me or not, because a few things I have and my standards are honesty, integrity, number one. Number two, no backstabbing and gossiping. And if I walk in and find you doing that, I will terminate you and I'll terminate the other person for listening. If you have nothing nice to say, don't say it at all. And I said, if you can work that, I'll keep you forever.
I like to show you around PSA, and I always call this side of the house, and then we go to the other side of the house.
How many are actually working in this building normally?
Normally in this building, 17. Across the U.S., we have 227, and we have an office in Chicago, and we have one in Gulfport, Mississippi. We have one in Texas and Washington, D.C.
Here you're a distinguished West Virginian, I can see, Judy.
Yes, that was a great honor. The governor had bestowed the highest honor on me that any West Virginian can get. I really treasure that particular distinguished award. And actually, when I just recently was invited to go to the White House and be with the president, the governor also gave me a pin so I could wear that. So I definitely had that on my lapel that day. So I'm very proud of that. So as we move over here to the other, we call this the other side of the house.
Okay, we've come to the other side of the building, as it were.
Yes. We'll start towards the back here and work our way forward. Steve, buzz down. Tell John and Derek to wait to work downstairs, please. Thank you. And we'll first knock on this door.
We meet various members of her staff in accounting and payroll, including young interns here on work experience. And then we go to recruiting.
This is John Doan. John came to work, it's been a couple years now, and when I first brought him in to see if he was interested, I think he thought I was kidding around with him. At the time, we were looking for a recruiter.
I was born with cerebral palsy. I've always been challenged to do whatever I put in front of me, with one exception. Mother and Dad told me never to play football.
That's a good idea.
I liked his attitude, so I thought by us helping John could probably reach out and help other people. So I thought he would probably find this challenging, but also exciting. And he was like, I don't know if I can do that. And I said, John, I think you can do anything you want. Now he's our senior recruiter over a new recruiter.
John has other talents, too. Judy prompts her senior recruiter to sing.
John, you're on.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high.
I've said that going to work for Judy is like going to Disney World and getting on Mr. Toad's wild ride. You just never know where you're going to end up.
That's Buddy Graham, Chief Operating Officer and Executive Vice President of Professional Services of America.
She's a dynamo. She's endless energy. She works from early in the morning to, I don't know when she sleeps, maybe a couple of hours a night. You know, I think she keeps her phone on. I don't think she ever turns it off. It's just unbelievable. Whereas other people have hobbies, I like to get out and play golf occasionally. Judy's hobby is work. She enjoys doing things, helping people. And, you know, that's the beauty of the thing is the fact that I don't think there's any other occupation or avocation in the world that suits her better than staffing and helping people and doing projects to creating wealth for other people, to helping people.
According to Graham, if a company or government department needs something done, the first thing Judy says is,
yes, I can do that.
And then they figure out how to do it. With this kind of attitude, in the last year alone, the company's gross revenue grew by more than $4 million.
Which is really unheard of for a small company. She loves a challenge, and she will take the challenge on regardless of how tough it might be, and we'll accomplish it.
In addition to her entrepreneurial skills, Judy Shepherd is a mother, and with her second husband, Gary, she's also a grandmother and a great-grandmother. But to get where she is today, Shepherd has come a very long way. Native American on her mother's side, one of six children, the house Judy K. Mace was born in was, as they say, way out in the sticks. It had dirt floors. And according to family legend, the day she was born, a cow came into the house and ate a cake her mother had baked. When Judy was four, the family moved.
We moved from there to a place called Fonzo. And Fonzo, West Virginia, would be in Ritchie County. And it's out off of 47. And that's where most of my childhood was spent. As they call in West Virginia, way up a holla. It was not an easy childhood looking back on it. But, you know, if you don't have it, you don't know. For example, you know, you didn't have the clothing. You know, you didn't have shoes. And the shoes I had was hand-me-downs. And, you know, you would stick stuff in them, try to make them fit. You rub blisters. But growing up, it was cold. We didn't have electricity. And we was expected to do a lot of chores, you know, from feeding to basically, you know, hoeing the corn to whatever it took to survive because we really lived a lot off the land. We did our own hunting. I used to use a 410 and a 22. And one year we canned, if you can imagine this, 99 squirrels. And that's what you really had to do to survive.
You canned 99 squirrels. Is that for the winter?
Yes, that was for the winter.
That was your protein for the winter?
That and deer. We would always get deer. I wouldn't want to eat it today, but we did groundhog. We did coons. I don't think my childhood, even though I had nothing, I learned a lot because if I had to survive today, I could survive.
And for Judy Shepherd, poverty and surviving off the land was the easy part.
Unfortunately, in the childhood, my father was a very bad alcoholic. Now, when I say that today, I understand what it means, but I didn't understand it then. But he would get drunk, and he was a very mean drunk. So my mother was very, very abused, and we were abused. It was also something you were not allowed to talk about. You were ashamed, and you were very embarrassed. And that was another thing. I just didn't understand why you couldn't talk about it. But as I walk back through into the childhood days, I get kind of goosebumpy, and yeah, it's kind of hard. It's not easy knowing, you know, you don't have food, you're cold, your father's very abusive, and you hear your mother and him being very abusive to your mother. She never talked about it, even when I wanted to talk to her later in life. She never wanted to talk about it. It took me a long time to understand it. So really and truthfully, I went to get help so I understood what that really meant in life. Because you blame yourself, and it really isn't children's fault.
To catch the bus to school, Judy walked 3 miles each way. She didn't see a television until she was in the 8th grade. In the 9th grade, when she started high school, she moved into a boarding house in Harrisville, the county seat of Ritchie County, owned by a Mrs. Bonnet. And for the first time, Judy had indoor plumbing.
It was really cheap. It wasn't anything fancy. So what I did is I took in ironing, and I did her chores. And then I could go carry groceries for people. And that's how I paid for my little bit of room and board.
When Judy's father became extremely violent, her parents separated, though they never divorced. Right after high school, Judy married and had a son, Rob. Shortly after that, her husband was drafted and sent to Vietnam. And on his return, they divorced. Sometimes working three jobs, Judy raised her son on her own. And when he was grown up, she married Gary Shepherd. Gary kindly agreed to drive us back to Fonzo, the isolated community where Judy grew up.
Judy, we've spent about an hour on the road. We're out in remotest Ritchie County.
Yeah, we are. We're getting ready to enter right now what a little place would be called Smithville, West Virginia, where I first attended elementary school, which was a one-room schoolhouse. It's over here immediately to your left. As you can see, the kids are out there now. We're getting ready to turn to the left, and this is Fonzo. You can see the sign.
There's Fonzo Road.
From this moment till the time we end, and then we walk, is how far I walk to catch the school bus. That's where I caught the school bus.
We pass some roads leading off to oil and gas wells, then a few houses, including the house of a couple, the Reeses, who used to give Judy a cup of hot water to help her keep warm on her walk to school.
The farther we go, kind of the more remote it gets, and kind of the more I call it closed in.
Finally, we get to a mobile home at the bottom of a hill. It belongs to Larry Sissons. For a while, Larry's aunt owned the house that Judy once lived in.
Back, I think, in 74, 76, somewhere in there, she had it burnt down. She burnt the place down because she had people in there that didn't supposed to be in there.
You going to walk with us?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
When was the last time you actually saw the house?
When I was in the 8th grade.
You have not seen the house since you were in the 8th grade?
Mm-mm. No.
From here on, the road is too rutted for a car. No. We decide to walk the final mile or so. Uphill.
My wife came down and took care of her 2 years before she died.
A half-hour trek through the mud, and we reach the gate to the property where Judy once lived.
We used to come right through there,
right,
to the house.
Right.
And the house sat right up there.
Right.
Wow.
You all right?
I'm okay.
Brings back memories, don't it? I know what it would do for me if I'd go back home.
We're here, Judy. Is this the foundation of the house, or is this the cellar?
Foundation of the house, because it's set up.
And that was the whole size of the house?
Yeah, it wasn't very big. I can remember right in here, and I don't know whose dog it was. The dog came into the yard and attacked my brother, who was 3, and took the side of his face off. There's still the scar here. And we grabbed him and ran clear to the top where Reese's lived to phone to get a car. I remember that as if it was yesterday. Because when you're way out here, you have nowhere to go for help.
Being here, though, is a reminder that you have come a long way.
You can come a long ways, but you have to be determined to do so. I tell people I don't want to forget. I want to help other people overcome those obstacles.
From the house in Fonzo, Judy takes me to Harrisville, where she went to high school, to the Five and Dime, where she shopped for Christmas presents, and the sandwich shop her late mother dearly loved. Buddy Graham, who works with Judy every day, is still amazed by what she achieves.
The education that she received was a lot greater in life's lessons than what you get out of a book. And you really appreciate the distance that she's come and the hardship she's overcome from her childhood up until today. It's just unreal. The great business decisions and the common sense. You just wonder how that she's gain this knowledge to grow this business to a multi-million dollar business. Not many people that maybe went to all these big business schools would make better decisions or as good at decisions.
With her success, Judy is intent on giving back to the people and the state that nurtured her. A couple of years ago, DuPont and PepsiCo asked PSA if they would assemble a small plastic piece for soda dispensers. Judy, of course, said, oh yes, we can do that. And it had the secret code name, the Widget Project.
It's an 8-part piece that they have to put together. Okay, it comes unassembled. Uh-huh. So this fits on the
But Judy knew that the sheltered workshop in Parkersburg, which employs people with disabilities, was struggling. Some of their clients hadn't worked in 8 years.
So we went over and seen Lori Cox, and she thought it would be a great project for them. So eventually come to fruition, we signed the contract, and that put 114 people to work at Sheltered Workshop, which they're still working.
Judy Shepherd feels that part of her mission in life is to help entrepreneurs, especially women entrepreneurs, across West Virginia and around the world. Currently, she is Distinguished West Virginian of the Year and Small Business Person of the Year for the U.S. Small Business Administration. Judy McCauley is the head of the SBA in West Virginia.
There are so many of us that were born and raised in this state that your heart's here. And most of those that start small businesses know that as they start succeeding, that they would probably be better off moving their company to a more metropolitan area. But individuals like Judy really put their state and their communities first. I think it is phenomenally important to West Virginia. Those are the people that truly are the advocates of this state, and they really are the ones that create the jobs.
I've had an opportunity to move numerous times. People's tried to buy me. They've offered me jobs to go other places. As a matter of fact, the job that I've always wanted all my life was on the table last year at this time. It was probably one of the hardest things I've walked from. If I walked from that, it meant closing this, and I just really could not do that to the state or to my employees. West Virginia, I feel like, has been very good to me, and I want to give back, and I'd never want to forget where my roots are from. I'm just always very proud about that, very proud to be able to say I am from West Virginia.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jean Snedeker.
That story originally aired in 2014. We chatted with Judy Shepherd this week to find out how things have been going. She's had a lot of letters from across the country from people who heard her story and were touched. She's even begun mentoring one young woman who moved to West Virginia from Texas to learn how to open her own business. And by the way, Judy also plans to write a memoir about her life. Thanks for listening to our show about trailblazing women. We hope you enjoyed these stories as much as we did. The pioneering road can be tough, but it's not impossible. And everybody loves a good underdog story, and here in Appalachia, we have plenty of them. So cheers to the female underdog.
If I can help somebody as I pass along, if I can cheer somebody with a word or a song, if I can show somebody that he's traveling wrong, then my living shall not be in vain.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from inspiring West Virginians. Music in today's show was provided by Darling Side with God of Loss as heard on Mountain Stage, Ben Townsend, Ollie Watts Davis, Effie Kathy Austin, and Jake Sheps. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Catherine Winter. Our audio mixing is by Scotty White. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thank you.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Its work with flakes of garlic.